This podcast covers all things health, your body, your brain, and your well-being. Each week, we'll be joined by doctors, as well as the occasional guest, to talk about the health topics that mean the most to you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Before we hear that conversation, a quick check-in. Have you subscribed to our show yet? Take a second if you can and make sure so you don't miss any of our great episodes. Thank you. There are three words no one ever wants to hear. You have cancer. But just about everyone knows someone who's gotten this very tough diagnosis. More than a million cases of cancer are diagnosed in the US every year, according to the American Cancer Society. But there's actually a lot you can do to lower your risk for many types of cancer. And some of those steps are actually surprisingly simple. So what exactly helps, and where should you start? We're talking about that today with Dr. John White.
Gary, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be with you today and talk about what we can all do to reduce our cancer risk.
So I'm curious what or who inspired you to write this book?
Gary, it really was this idea that, you know, how do we prevent disease? I'm an internist. I still see patients. We focus on treating people when they actually have symptoms, when they actually have disease. And over the 25 years I've been practicing, we often focus prevention efforts around diseases like diabetes. You know, we tell people, you want to watch your weight. You want to watch what you eat because you don't want to get diabetes. We do the same thing with heart disease in terms of don't eat too many fatty foods. Even when you have a heart attack, the whole focus is on, you know, how do you prevent the next one? But Kerry, we never do that with cancer. We never talk to patients about what are some steps other than screening that you can do to reduce your cancer risk.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Here is a quick word from our sponsor.
We take this few seconds off to inform you, our valued loyal listener, about the best health and fitness podcast shows from the Nespod Studios. Join us as we give you the best of the best health and wellness updates you can rely on for the treatment of chronic health problems. classic functional medicine back to basics health tips and special updates from the best doctors in the United States of America. Check out this health and wellness podcast shows. Explore Health Talk Weekly, Healthy Lifestyle Matters, Excellent Health Digest, Healthy and Free Daily, and last but not least, Weekly Health and Fitness Corner. Also, check out Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told fiction podcast, for that real life on the go experience with the 27-year-old golden boy, who made our guest invite number one list. He tells us about his story as it happens in real time and in real life. It's Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told. Go get a load of that happiness, because happiness is healthy as we know it. Join us every week as we continue to provide you the best of health and fitness wellness updates from around the globe. Enjoy the show.
And now, back to our episode.
And I'm curious, that term cancer risk, it seems straightforward, but I think it can actually get a little complicated. So can you explain exactly what that term risk really means and what kinds of things affect that risk?
Right. And you talked about at the beginning that, you know, a million cases of cancer are diagnosed every year. Well, guess what? 600,000 people die every year from cancer. So it's still a leading cause of death. And when we talk about risk, it's really what's your chances of getting cancer? And if you look at lifetime risk, in general, most people have 1 out of 3 chance of getting cancer during their lifetime.
Wow.
That includes benign cancers like skin cancers, but it's 1 in 3. 1 out of every 3 people will be diagnosed with cancer during their lifetime. That's why we all know someone that has cancer, probably several people. 1 out of 5, that's your risk of dying from cancer. So we have to put that all in perspective. You know, heart disease has a greater risk. Getting diabetes is significant as well. But people don't often think about what's their risk of getting cancer. And that's the first step you need to know as you think about, well, I want to reduce my risk, because that risk is pretty high in terms of what may happen over your lifetime.
It almost seems like there's kind of a, you know, an element of kind of fate to a cancer diagnosis. Either you're going to get it or you're not. Right. And I think you even said in the book, the biggest myth that you hear is that cancer is completely genetic, like it's totally just out of your hands, whether you will get it or you won't. Tell us why that's a myth.
It turns out that roughly 20 to 30% of all cancer cases are due to inherited mutations. That's a fancy word for basically genetics, that you have some predisposition to some type of cancer. But those are very few. The majority of cases of cancer are influenced by lifestyle, what we eat, how active we are, the quality of your sleep, the amount of stress that we have in our lives, our environment. But people don't think about it that way. They think, in some ways, I don't have any family history. I don't know anyone that has cancer in my family, so I'm not at risk. So I don't need to worry about a screening. I hear that time and time again. Or I took the 23andMe test or one of the other tests that screen for genetic risks of cancer. And that's an important point. It doesn't look for other cases. It's really only looking for that 20 to 30% that have inherited mutations. And as you kind of point out, some people think it's just luck, it's fate. Most of the time it's not. And that's the reason why I want to empower people with this knowledge that then allows them to take control of their risk, because they really do have that power when it comes to cancer. Not for everyone. And there's going to be people, Carrie, that do everything right and still get a cancer diagnosis, because 20 to 30% of cancer is related to inherited mutations and other factors. But overall, for most people and most cancers, there's a lot you can do to reduce your risk.
So I'm sure you've probably met people who are a little bit
fatalistic about this. You've mentioned it already. Like, you know, if it's in the cards for me, mm-hmm. that's just the way it is. You know, I grew up with family members who would say, well, you got to die of something. So what would you say to those people who have that approach or who just kind of think that way, but give them some information that would help them feel like it really is in their hands?
Yeah. And, you know, I have patients that say to me, they know so-and-so, you know, who did everything right, like I just referenced, and they still got cancer. So they're not going to be worried that if they smoke or drink a lot of alcohol or overweight, that they're going to be impacted by them, because it seems like it's just fate. And the reality is to try to help them understand that, no, it's not. And a cancer diagnosis is no walk in the park. Even though we have these amazing advances in treatment and targeted therapies, there's still bad outcomes. There's still a lot of impact on one's quality of life. Doesn't necessarily mean people will live longer. And I'm not sure, all things, you know, being equal, would I choose a cancer diagnosis as the fatal blow as opposed to something else? The other challenge I really make people think about, Carrie, is, you know, if you're diagnosed with diabetes, you have opportunities to change your lifestyle. Often if you're diagnosed with heart disease, most people don't die from a heart attack the first time. Some people do, but the majority do not. You have an opportunity to change your lifestyle, change the outcome of your life. Cancer diagnoses, you don't always have that. So it's, what can we do now to prevent a diagnosis later? And it's a mindset that takes time for people to change, because you're right, no one really taught them, really, how much I eat, how well I sleep, that's going to impact whether or not I get cancer. So it takes some work.
A lot of people are aware of that, like you were saying, with heart disease and diabetes, a lot of people are aware of that connection. But with cancer, it seems like it's an extra leap that we're not always aware of.
Well, that's because we have so many awareness campaigns around heart disease.
That's true.
And diabetes, and we tell people the relationship so they know about it. I mean, there's still people that deny the relationship of weight and food with diabetes, for type 2 diabetes or for heart disease. But most doctors aren't telling their patients, these are the things that you need to do in hopes that you don't get cancer later on in life.
So I do want to talk about the actual specifics of the steps people can take to lower their risk. But for people who do have that family history of cancer, mm-hmm. are there extra things that they should be doing to lower their risk, since they already know that it's higher than other people's?
Right. And we see that in some type of breast cancers. Many people have heard of BRCA 1 and 2. We see that in some type of colorectal cancers, often those that are diagnosed at an early age. These are due to inherited mutations. Often you should talk to a genetic counselor at a cancer center who can help advise you. Sometimes you might have to consider prophylactic treatment. By that I mean, some people may choose to have a mastectomy ahead of time if they're at greater risk for breast cancer that's related to genetics.
And that's a surgery where you remove one or both breasts.
That's right.
Okay.
In terms of colon cancer, you might need to be screened, undergo colonoscopy, that scope that's inserted up through your rectum earlier on, or you might even need to have it inserted down your throat to look for other type of cancers in your GI tract. And there are instances where, depending upon if you are at increased risk, you might need to start certain medications to decrease that risk. That often happens at times as well after you have cancer, to prevent recurrence in some type. So it is important to make sure that you talk to your cancer doctor about what you might need to do if you have these inherited mutations that put you at increased risk due to genetics.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, let's talk about some of the specific ways you recommend lowering cancer risk. And one of them is exercise. And I was surprised, actually, by just how many ways physiologically exercise can affect your cancer risk. Can you go over some of those for us?
Exercise really is a type of wonder drug. And if you think about it, do you ever regret going to the gym or working out, right? It might take some effort to get there, but how do you feel after you went? You feel like you're, you know, king of the hill.
That's yeah. what I'm really glad I did that. That's yeah, what I usually
that's right. That's right. And you know why? Because you have the release of endorphins, those feel good hormones that, you know, work in certain centers of your brain to give you pleasure. But we see it more in terms of reducing stress hormone, cortisol. It reduces inflammation throughout your body. And it has a role of powerful antioxidants. And, you know, antioxidants are, it's almost like anti tends to be a bad word, but it's a good thing. So there's these things called these free radicals. And I'm in Washington, D.C., and sometimes you think, well, free radical, that sounds good. You know, you're free and you're radical. But free radical really are these molecules that cause clots and strokes. And antioxidants are things that kind of mop up the free radicals and prevent them from doing harm. So exercise has a role in that. And we'll come to that, but other things have an antioxidant role. But it really is a powerful role in reducing inflammation. And what we've learned over the last few years is that in some ways, cancer is an inflammatory process. And inflammation early on, say after you have an injury, is normal because you have a lot of molecules and cells that come to help repair if you have knee pain. But it's this chronic inflammation that is helping cancer cells reproduce, divide, and find areas of the body to live. Exercise helps reduce that. So that's why exercise is such a powerful component of a personal cancer prevention program.
That's really amazing to think of, you know, you think about strengthening your heart and your muscles when you're working out, but not all those other more downstream effects. That's fascinating.
Yeah, we call it cardio. I mean, when you think about it, you know, that implies it's just the heart, but it's these other elements as well.
That's a very good point. Another habit I was surprised to find in a book about cancer risk was sleep. But it sounds like, and you can tell me if I have this right, like there are so many key processes that are happening in your body while you're sleeping. And when you miss out on that, when you're not sleeping enough, that affects your cancer risk. Is that kind of the general idea?
Absolutely. It's really not just that our bodies are like the computers that are going into sleep mode. It's really, if you think about it, your brain and body are clearing out all the toxins and other aspects of your physiology when you sleep. And that's why it's so important to get good quality sleep. There's certainly a role of several hormones involved with sleep. Melatonin as a hormone, not necessarily as the supplement, but melatonin plays an important role in sleep, and so does cortisol. They actually work in different ways. And again, the reason why they're important is this role of inflammation. And how do we reduce inflammation? And what's fascinating is in recent years, we've seen increased incidence in certain types of cancer in shift workers, people that work typically at night in unusual hours, and then they have trouble sleeping during the day. And multiple studies have been done. And in some areas of the world, they have actually, governments have reimbursed women that have been shift workers with increased incidence of breast cancer.
Interesting.
It's Medscape actually covered this several years ago, our colleagues at Medscape. It shows the role that sleep has, getting good quality sleep, in making sure that your body functions well. And here's a thought to consider as we're in the fall and the winter, people will get colds and flus. What's the first thing you do, Carrie, when you have a cold or the flu?
Ooh, I do try to get more sleep.
Absolutely. What do you? You try to take off work, you go to bed and think, I'll sleep it off, right?
Right.
Because what's happening there? Your body is improving your immune function. You're giving your body a rest. You're bringing white blood cells to where they need to go to help fight infection. You wouldn't stay up all day when you're not feeling well. You'd feel worse. So it's not a surprise when we think about it, the role of sleep in lowering our cancer risk.
That makes a lot, now that you say it that way, it does make a lot of sense, but I would never have connected those two things just off the top. That's very interesting. Another habit you talk about in the book is what we eat. And kind of like we've discussed a minute ago, I think most people are aware of the connection between their diet and heart disease, for example, but not cancer. What does the research say there?
I always tell patients, if they made one change to begin with, they have to rethink about food and consider food is medicine. It's as powerful as a prescription drug. So when you're deciding, Carrie, do you want to eat those potato chips or do you want to eat an orange? If you think about what are going to be the effects on your body. So what we've seen over time in terms of red meat and processed meat particularly is the impact on cancer, particularly colorectal cancer, increased incidence of it. It's been consistently shown over time. We know that people that don't eat a lot of fruits and vegetables also have increased incidence of cancer. Too much alcohol consumption also increases one's risk of certain types of cancer, not just liver cancer, but also breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is, I don't want people to think you can never have a hamburger. You can never have alcohol. It's the consistent food choices that you make over time on a daily basis. And it's as important what you exclude as well as what you include. So you have to look at it both ways. So if you want to say, okay, I'm going to start eating fish. And most people don't eat fish mm-hmm. once a week, and we'd like them to eat it twice a week. Right. But I tell people that doesn't mean you include fish and have surf and turf. Right. It means you have fish. And the reasons why fish is so powerful is, first of all, it's low in calories. So you're going to decrease calories and weight, and weight has a component, obesity in terms of your cancer risk. It has omega-3 fatty acids. It's chock full of those. It has those powerful antioxidants that I just talked about. And that's always going to be a better choice than, I'm going to be honest, having bacon, a bologna sandwich, salami. I mean, your mouth is probably watering now as I'm saying this, but if you think about it, they are salted, they are processed, they are refined, and refined is not a good term as it relates to food. So again, it doesn't mean that you can never have it, but we're eating that too many times a day. I mean, I grew up having lunch meat on white bread, as part of my lunch. That's not what I do now because I know the long-term impact of eating like that in terms of increasing cancer risk. So that doesn't mean you can't make a sandwich, but ideally it's on whole wheat or it's an avocado toast or it's, you know, meat that you made at home, a chicken breast, and then you slice. It takes a little more time. And meal planning is a critical component of a personal cancer prevention program. But it's well worth your time.
So if you were talking to someone and encouraging them to build like an anti-cancer meal plan for the week, let's say, what kinds of things would you advise that they put on their grocery list?
The biggest thing I mention is fruits and vegetables. And I ask people, did you eat any fruit today? I could ask you, have you eaten any fruit yet today?
I ate some fruit this morning, actually. Okay, I had some pomegranates.
But most people do not, you know, not an orange, not a apple. So I don't make it complicated that you have to have it at every meal, but in many ways you have to start having it every day. You have to include green leafy vegetables. That's an important component. And these don't just help with cancer prevention. They help with other areas of your health as well. So I focus on those areas first. Let's start including things. So remember, I said it's exclude, include, but I don't want to make too many changes at once. And sometimes it's easier to start including things that you haven't eaten before and then removing things. Most people I have to say, start with fish, just once a week. Let's just start with that and try it for a month. And then move to twice a week and then remove some of those other things. I mean, there are so many foods that are healthy that people can enjoy. But as we get older, we tend to become more stubborn. Oh, I don't like broccoli. I don't like, you know, whole wheat. I don't like yogurt. I actually had a patient one day say to me, because I'm like, the first thing you can do is eliminate soda. She drank a lot of soda. And she's like, well, what should I drink? Tea? I'm not making it up. I was like, no, she meant iced tea. I said, you could drink water. And she actually said to me, I don't like water.
I hear that from people too. It's like, water's too boring. I don't like drinking it.
But you know, I convinced her, and this actually worked for me because I used to drink soda a long time ago. And I changed it by drinking sparkling water. And that was kind of my first transition, flavored sparkling water. And then I transitioned to regular water. And it took time, but you know, I kept at it. And that's sometimes what you have to do and encourage people. And you might think, how do people not know that drinking soda, you know, every day is a bad thing? A lot of people drink soda every day. And it's thinking about making those changes. And there's very little, if any, health benefit from soda. And even diet soda has been shown not to be helpful.
I was just going to say, because a lot of people will say, oh, I'm not drinking regular soda. I'm drinking diet soda, so it's okay.
Diet soda has consistently shown not to help people lose weight. And there's a couple of reasons why that is. I mean, one of them is these artificial sweeteners are so intensely sweet that they actually trick your brain into thinking that there's going to be a sugar load coming. And then your body starts to crave sweets. And this may happen with people at 3 o'clock when they get a diet soda, typically when we're in the office and have a vending machine. And then what do they typically get with it? A candy bar or a cookie or, you know, a cupcake because they want something sweet. Or we've seen that people that drink diet soda overestimate the number of calories that they're saving. So, you know, you heard the joke, we'll have a cheeseburger, you know, fries, and then we say Diet Coke. So then it's all okay.
of course.
But it's not. So we end up actually consuming more calories than if we had just been drinking a regular soda. So I hate to disappoint people, but drinking diet soda is not a good idea. But eliminating calorie-rich beverages is a good strategy to start to lose weight. So it's eliminating soda, fruit juices, and really trying to move to things like water.
And you mentioned this in the book, and I've heard this previously, but I'm so fascinated by actually the role that spices can play in lowering cancer risk, which could be helpful if you're looking to cut back on sodium, salting your food to give it some flavor. Right. You can replace that with spices. But are there specific spices you can call out that are kind of interesting for cancer risk?
You know, absolutely. And I've learned more about herbs and spices over the past few years. And that's just really my ignorance in a way, because when you think about it, herbs and spices to treat disease have been around for centuries, if not millennia. And I even remember early on in my training, before we had these powerful anti-nausea drugs, Zofran and Dancertron, we would talk about using ginger or ginger ale at that time that did have some ginger. Most of it do not now, to help treat nausea. But sometimes I tell people it's things with G's. It's things like, as I mentioned, ginger, which has some of these antioxidant properties, which actually has some role in reducing pain. We think it's because they're reducing inflammation. Garlic has a very powerful role in terms of reducing inflammation. It actually helps your white blood cells fight bacteria and even fungi of different types of fungus. That's been consistently shown. So some people say you should have a clove of garlic a day. The other one is ginseng. So I make it easier for people. Think of things with G. You know, ginseng is very good. It has what's called these different immunoglobulins, which can help reduce inflammation. Turmeric, has consistently been shown to be a very powerful spice as well in terms of antioxidant properties. Cayenne pepper has a role. I mean, it's basically really any type of spice, which is great when you think about fish, because people be like, I don't really like the smell of fish or the taste mm-hmm. of fish, but adding these spices can really liven up the flavor of different foods and really can be kind of fun doing it. My wife and I were using some different Middle Eastern spices on shrimp last night. And I thought, this is really tasty. It tasted different. And it gives you an opportunity to try different things. The great thing is they're low in calories as well. There's not one particular spice that's going to, you know, completely reduce your cancer risk. But as you think about what you're including and what you're excluding and aspects that have medicinal properties that we've known for centuries, that's going to have an impact on reducing your cancer risk.
As I was listening to you talk about the different kind of herbs and spices that can reduce cancer risk, I was thinking some people might hear that.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Here is a quick word from our sponsor.
We take this few seconds off to inform you, our valued loyal listener, about the best health and fitness podcast shows from the Nespod Studios. Join us as we give you the best of the best health and wellness updates you can rely on for the treatment of chronic health problems. Classic functional medicine back to basics health tips and special updates from the best doctors in the United States of America. Check out this health and wellness podcast shows. Explore Health Talk Weekly, Healthy Lifestyle Matters, Excellent Health Digest, Healthy and Free Daily, and last but not least, Weekly Health and Fitness Corner. Also, check out Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told fiction podcast, for that real life on the go experience with the 27-year-old golden boy, who made our guest invite number one list. He tells us about his story as it happens in real time and in real life. It's Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told. Go get a load of that happiness, because happiness is healthy as we know it. Join us every week as we continue to provide you the best of health and fitness wellness updates from around the globe. Enjoy the show.
And now, back to our episode.
And think, oh, I've seen that in a supplement at the drugstore, so maybe I can just take that and that'll make a difference. I'm sure you hear that approach from your patients as well. What would you say, or what would you want people to know about these kinds of vitamins and supplements that are marketed to lower cancer risk? And where would you want people to go for reliable information about those?
Whole foods are always going to be better than having it as a supplement. And there's sometimes issues with purity of supplements. The way the body may digest a pill may be different than it is in a whole food or a spice that's added to it and then cooked and seasoned with it. So the better choice is always going to be to use the spice and have it as a whole food, rather than to think there's a magic pill in a bottle, because there are no magic pills.
Yeah, we would have probably discovered that by
That's
now,
right.
I would think.
That's right. So people may be wasting their money at times on some of the supplements that are promoting that they, you know, reduce cancer. I would encourage people to focus on the whole foods and then adding spices to it directly, rather than trying to buy a mega dose in a bottle, because there's other aspects. So I could say kale has lots of fiber, other nutrients, but it also has other health benefits as well that you're not going to get from a pill. And that's the big difference.
Are there places that people can go if they have a question about something they're taking, whether or not it would be worth it? Are there resources they can check to sort of, you know, get more reliable information on those things?
You know, and the FDA does have a page relating to supplements. There's something called USP, United States Pharmacopoeia. They often will do a lot in terms of supplements and vitamins. They've been a leader in the terms of omega-3 fatty acids pills, of trying to work in some type of symbols for consumers to know the purity of the supplements and what they've undergone. So those are two sites that folks can go to besides WebMD to look for some additional information.
Of course, we can't forget WebMD. We do have a lot of really good information on those things. So good to call that out. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's talk about cancer screening. Mm-hmm. We're not always so great at keeping up with things like mammograms and mm-hmm. colonoscopies or skin exams, especially after the pandemic when a lot of folks kind of dialed back the medical care they were getting or the in-person care. So help us get that back on track.
Absolutely. People have not come in for their routine screening, partly because we told people not to come in, that it wasn't safe to come in. Well, now it is safe to come in. And there's a concern that we're going to miss diagnoses. A physician friend of mine who's a head and neck cancer specialist told me that the pre-pandemic, he would typically see one new advanced case, a case that has spread of cancer a week. And for 8 months of the pandemic, roughly, he saw no new cases.
Wow. Well,
why would that have all of a sudden stopped, right? So there are people perhaps that have delayed diagnosis. You know, and I tease patients, it's always the colonoscopy they don't show up for. They're like, oh, was it this day, Dr. White? Or, oh, I didn't have a ride. I did like the prep. They always have an excuse for the colonoscopy, and I really have to work on them. But now we have other technologies as well in terms of different stool tests and in mammograms, we have, you know, more advanced testing. One point I want to mention is when we see the guidelines from the American Cancer Society, and I talk about them in my book, those are for people that are average risk. So say in breast cancer, if you have a family member who was diagnosed at an early age or in multiple family members, that's, you're not at average risk. In colorectal cancer, if someone was diagnosed with cancer in their 20s and 30s, you're not at average risk. So the guideline's going to apply differently to you. I mean, most people don't get a skin exam, and I try to do skin exams on patients once a year. And sometimes they're really surprised, but I'm like, you know, I have to see your back, right? You have to disrobe. And everyone doesn't do that. You can't do a skin exam, a comprehensive skin exam on yourself. It's just very hard to see certain areas of your body. And there's nodes that develop in certain areas of our body, particularly under our armpits and our groin and our clavicle, a bone in the upper part of our chest, that sometimes can be hard to feel for yourself. So you do want an expert to feel for that. And certainly when you have a suspicious lesion, something that looks like it's changing over time, it's not going away, you do want to get checked out. I mean, the good news is, in skin cancer, we have some apps now that people can use to get some type of preliminary read where they can take a picture, upload it, and it can be reviewed by a dermatologist. But screening is one of the most effective ways to catch cancer early on. Sadly, we don't have screening for every type of cancer, things like pancreatic cancer and some others. And that's why it's still important to think about ways to reduce your risk. Screening is a critical component of trying to prevent cancer from progressing. And I really want to encourage people to talk to their doctor, to go back in, to get those screenings that you might have missed, and definitely catch up soon. Because I'm concerned that 1 year turns into 3 years, turns into 5 years, and people don't come back. And I'll tell you an example, Carrie, of someone I saw recently who had prostate cancer several years ago. And his screening was different because he's not at average risk. And pre-pandemic, he had not been seen in about 6 years. And, you know, his point was he didn't felt he needed to. He said he was busy. And sometimes there's the fear of finding out, right? Mm-hmm. FOFO, I call in my book. Sometimes you call fear of missing out, but fear of finding out. That's why sometimes people don't go for screening. They don't want to know.
Right.
But you want to know. And his did not turn out well. He had a recurrence of his cancer that had progressed a fair amount. But the point is, if you don't go get screened, then we don't have enough information. And for most people, you want to have that information to make the best decision about the next steps with your doctor. And there is a fear of finding out. I'm going to be honest. Some people, that's why they don't go.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we've made a lot of progress in cancer treatments. And if you have it, you want to have the best strategy, the best chance of beating it.
Tell me a little bit about, because I think, and I think you even mentioned this a moment ago, I think people might think, I feel fine. I don't have any symptoms. Why would I go get this screening? Tell us a little bit about the role of symptoms in cancer. Are you always going to have symptoms if you have cancer that you would notice?
Right. So not all cancer present early on with some type of symptoms, or they present with symptoms that you easily dismiss as something else. You know, in some ways with brain cancer, we have an awareness of headaches, right? So I see a lot of patients that come in with headaches and are concerned about brain cancer. 99.8 times out of 100, it's not a brain cancer, but they kind of know that warning sign, so they're quick on it. Although it's typically a certain presentation, often at night, it's, you know, for many hours, it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. The other element that I always work up very aggressively is when people have unintentional weight loss. Mm. And that's usually about 10% of your body weight. That's a big concern. And sometimes people don't realize they lost weight, or it's progressed too much till someone has told them it looks like they lose weight. Everyone doesn't weigh themselves, and we've all been wearing sweats lately.
Not necessarily conscious if your jeans are fitting a little tighter.
But it also can present in other ways that, you know, people might have abdominal pain and they're saying that's stress, and they may go see their doctor, and their doctor may also say it's stress and try different things. And it takes 2 or 3 years. And then it turns out they've had pancreatic cancer. I know that happened to a very good friend of mine, someone earlier today that I was talking to for something that we're working on at WebMD. Is the person, you know, was young and was doing everything right, but it turned out that she was having problems with her bowel movements. And the doctor was like, oh, maybe it's irritable bowel syndrome, changing diet. And it turned out she had a mass in her colon. She had a good outcome because it was found, but often we ignore symptoms. That's the biggest issue. We ignore them. We attribute it to something else. I'm having back pain. It's because I'm getting older. It's because I exercised. And you don't immediately think it's a metastasis, you know, a tumor spread to my bone, but sometimes it is.
Or I'm very tired. Or,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Often in blood cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, that's often a symptom. People are tired a lot, right? And sometimes they think the doctor might even dismiss it and say it's depression because that's not high on their list. But we need to empower consumers with the right information about what are those signs and symptoms. Everything, of course, is non-cancer, but we have to tease out when it might be, and then what's the right screening or testing that one needs to do in your individual circumstance. It's all about your individual circumstance. It's all about your personal cancer prevention program based on your risk. And I included several risk calculators in the book. And this is kind of frustrating because a lot of my colleagues don't go over it with patients in terms of, you know, put these numbers in, put these different factors in, and it'll tell you what your lifetime risk is of a certain type of cancer. And that can help you manage your screening interval and screening frequency. And that's the other thing, Carrie. Sometimes people will be like, oh, I got a, you know, mammogram 5 years ago and it was normal. Well, that's not the guidelines, right? Or a colonoscopy. I've seen patients that have a polyp and they'll be like, oh, I didn't think I needed it. They took it out. I didn't think I needed to come back. And usually, depending upon what it was, it's 3 to 5 years. And that's one good aspect of certain electronic health records. I go back and I look at it, and I was like, well, no, actually it wasn't normal. I mean, that's the doctor's fault for not explaining it well and giving patients a copy and making it clear. But we want to focus on not just screening, but also recognizing those signs and symptoms.
Right. My final question for you, I'm wondering, as you have studied cancer and learned more about it, are there specific changes that you have made to your lifestyle that you, you know, just in the service of trying to lower your cancer risk?
I actually, while in the course of writing the book, decided to get a smartwatch to monitor my physical activity output, because I was gaining weight because I wasn't eating healthy, as well as to monitor my sleep so I could make sure I was getting quality sleep. And I really have made a renewed effort to be more physically active. That's something that I had gotten away from even pre-pandemic. And I'll tell you, my wife and I are cooking more fish. So we're trying a lot of different things. I've ordered some things online, to be honest, at certain stores that send it post it, because I'm like, oh, that makes it easier. And I've been trying a lot of spices. I've been trying a lot of different things, but that's over the period of last year. But I recognize, and it's hard for everyone. Here I am, I've written a book on it, and it's still hard for me to make changes and be consistent. And
right. Like, well, because there's a lot of different things that can affect it.
And I have ups and downs, just like everyone else. So there are some weeks where we don't eat any fish, and there are some weeks where I don't do any exercise. But I try to be more consistent over time. And for me, the smartwatch has helped me track things. So I know, hey, I need to do more these last couple of days, or I didn't have a good week last week, so I need to make a renewed effort. And that has helped me. That's not for everyone, but that's an effort that I've been using to help take more control of my risk. I've always been good about screening. I'll be honest, I tend to be pretty good about that, although I was a year late or so of my colonoscopy, like other people, but it was on my list. But I'm trying to make those changes that I've been writing about. And back to the earlier point, it's about those consistent choices over time. So we all have bad days. We all have bad weeks, but we don't want bad days and weeks turn into months and years where we don't do any type of healthy habits that are going to reduce our cancer risk.
Right. Bringing awareness to your habits and just whether or not you can meet those marks for sure. Dr. John White, thank you so much for talking with us today and giving us a clue to these very powerful tools that we all have to lower our risk for cancer. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity, Carrie.
This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you.
We have a great show today, but first, take a second to make sure you've subscribed to our show wherever you're listening to podcasts. It's the best way to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks.
Please take a moment to follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite podcast listening platform.
This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you.